Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 247 launches us into an intense period. We're going to travel to the border between the Zulu Kingdom and the Transvaal because there's trouble brewing. Shenanigans are planned by British Governor Sir Bartle Frere, his partner in crime, Sir Theophilus Shepstone, who in 1877 had just completed 30 years' service as Secretary for Native Affairs in Natal for the Zulus. The transformation of the Native Affairs Secretary into the administrator of the newly annexed Transvaal was a serious development. As historian Jeff Guy points out, it destroyed the diplomatic link forged between Cetshwayo Kaampandi and Shepstone at a particularly sensitive moment in history. Previously, Shepstone had been sympathetic to the Zulu in their border dispute with the Boers, but once the Natal official took office in the Transvaal, that sentiment shifted. The pressure of trying to reconcile the Boers to their newly annexed state was too much for Shepstone. He did not have the emotional courage nor the courage of his convictions to balance the needs and wants of both the Boers and the Zulu. "He turned his coat in the most shameless manner," one colonial office official by the name of Fairfield wrote in a minute to Edward Stanley, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, after the coming war. Shepstone believed that if he could settle the northern Zululand border dispute, the Boers would fall into line in the Transvaal. After 30 years of working with various AmaZulu kings, the experience appears to have taught him very little about how to read the room. This prevarication, this insensitivity was going to doom thousands of Zulu and British soldiers. Shepstone had also made a leap into Darwinism. He'd gone from believing his influence over the Zulu was based on something other than his office and the coercive force he controlled. Now he based his actions on his belief that his status as the representative of what he believed was a superior civilization. He also truly believed that he could think like a Zulu, which is a curious and contorted contradiction if you think about it. With all these late Victorian threads woven through his fevered mind, he rode off to meet a Zulu deputation to the west of the Ngome/Blood River on the 18th of October, 1877. 300 AmaZulu delegates gathered at a flat-topped hill, henceforth to be known as Conference Hill. Shepstone had brought a handful of Transvaal officials and a small section of British soldiers. The AmaZulu side was led by Mnyamana of the Buthelezi clan. Instead of continuing to support Cetshwayo's historical claim to much of the land around this contested river, there north of Vryheid, around Utrecht, Dundee, Danhauser, Shepstone did an about-face. The AmaZulu delegation was shocked at the 180-degree turnaround. Someone they'd trusted and worked with for decades suddenly did a volte-face. Mnyamana in particular was incensed that he and his men had been tricked, along with the Zulu king. Shepstone had betrayed them because he was now demanding they agree to hand over most of the contested land to the Boers of the Transvaal. Sikwele Kwele of the Ingobamakosi spoke for all the Zulu delegates. "Is it so then, Mr. Shepstone, that after two men have been friends, and then one of them dies and leaves his son fatherless, that the surviving man ought to be harsh with the son of the deceased?" Shepstone had regarded himself as a friend of Mpandika Senzangakona, previous king of the Zulu, Cetshwayo's father. Shepstone tried to avoid their accusations. "I have only come to talk about the boundary of the country, but the English nation will come and settle matters for you. Go and tell my child these words, because I know that he will understand me." The Induna of the Emangweni royal homestead, Bejani, was present. He was also the Nneku, personal attendant of the king. Shepstone's patronizing tone was too much for him, and he stood up and spoke for the king when he said, "Somseo, we do not understand you." Up until now, Shepstone had been calm, a kind of grandfather talking to his troubled grandson attitude. But that mask slipped. He became very angry and yelled, "Who is that calling me by my name and not addressing me as Inkosi?" One of the chiefs retorted, "There is no Inkosi in our country. Although a man be an Inkosi, we chiefs call him by his name." With that, Mnyamana struck his shield with his assegai and left the meeting, followed by the other Zulu delegates. As he rode away from Conference Hill, Shepstone was thinking dark thoughts. He was shaken by both Mnyamana's language and the threatening stance taken by the Zulu. Shepston believed that Cetshwayo was clearly in a warlike mood and was coordinating Southern African-wide attempts at undoing the white rule on the continent. In Zulu oral tradition, this incident became the event which heralded the start of the war and the undoing of Cetshwayo. Sir Bartle Frere, the British High Commissioner in Cape Town, was determined to eradicate what he thought of as the Zulu threat. He was still busy sorting out the Ninth Frontier War against the Xhosa and watching the Pedi battle the Boers in the northeastern Transvaal. While that irritating sideshow, at least in Frere's mind, continued, here was Cetshwayo openly defying his affairs man in Natal. Shepston, in a giant leap of logic, then warned Frere that Sekukuni of the Pedi was actually acting as a kind of lieutenant to the baleful Zulu king. Before the next steps, let's go over a few important facts. Shepston and Cetshwayo had been working in harmony since the Zulu king's inauguration in 1873. They had an agreement of the recruitment of migrant labour for Natal from the Tsonga chiefs to the northeast of the Zulu territory, south of Delagoa Bay, wedged between the Zulu and the Swazi. The Tsonga paid tribute to Cetshwayo, and Tsonga work seekers of a few thousand a year were allowed to pass through Zululand on their way to Natal. In return, Cetshwayo received a fee for every migrant registering for work in Natal. Cetshwayo also received a tax from these migrants returning home. A whopping one-third of their salary was pocketed by the Zulu king. Shepston had been quite happy allowing Cetshwayo to wield power at home. Suddenly now he was the threat. Cetshwayo himself needed the cash. During his massive coronation ceremony, over 100,000 head of cattle had been rounded up throughout his kingdom and paraded before him. He reapportioned some to his favourite amakanda or homesteads, gifts, you could say. Unfortunately, the gifts were a poisoned chalice. During the week of the massive herd parade, a handful of the cattle that were suffering from deadly lung sickness transmitted the affliction to thousands of others, devastating the king's herds. Taxing migrant workers was a good way for the king to earn some dosh. Cetshwayo was building an armory with that tax cash, importing firearms and gunpowder as quickly as he could. Muskets had always been smuggled into Zululand since the first elephant hunters and traders arrived at Port Natal in 1823. By the end of the 1860s, firearms were spreading rapidly throughout southern Africa. As you know, Englishman and now Zulu chief John Dunn was a prime gunrunner. He needed the cash too. By now, Dunn had accumulated 48 Zulu wives to add to his one Cape Malay wife. Dunn's trick was to buy the guns from Natal traders, load them aboard a ship, sail to Delagoa Bay, offload and distribute from there. No problem with the Natal authorities, who knew what was going on, by the way. Were they bribed? Possibly. However, by mid-1878, there were about 20,000 firearms in Zululand. I'll come back to the role of firearms because the reality is Cetshwayo hoarded them instead of deploying them into his amabutu. That was going to have tactical implications later because he treated firearms as a symbol of power rather than a tool of power. Back in the Transvaal, Shepston was furious and he muttered to his team about marching soldiers into Zululand. In January 1878, 4 months after the chastising conference held debacle, he wrote a letter to Frere saying he discovered the most incontrovertible, overwhelming and clear evidence that he'd been previously unaware of, supporting Boer claims to Zulu territory. He never did produce this evidence, nor do we know what it was, but it gives you an idea about what was going on in his mind. 3 days later, he wrote another dispatch expounding on the dangers to Southern Africa of the Zulu military system. Zulu society, he said, was a vicious military despotism in which every male was taught to fight. He failed to mention in that dispatch that he had previously supported the very same system, but now was dead set against it. Deploying the narrative that the Zulu culture was like an engine, he said it was used to generate power, the accumulation of which is now kept pent up in this machine. Those forces have continued to accumulate and are daily accumulating without a safety valve. Sir Bartle Frere, of course, lapped all of this up, and the British High Commissioner increased his attacks on Cetshwayo and the kingdom in a manner which featured an almost hysterical persistence. He began to pursue a policy of war in spite of the evidence before him that Cetshwayo was bending over backwards to avoid fighting the British. Historians believe Freer had developed a kind of fanaticism, and worse, an utter disregard for the lives of those he believed were obstructing his great plan, a confederation of South African states. Cetshwayo then approached Natal's Lieutenant Governor Sir Henry Bulwer, after whom the town of Bulwer is named. By now, it was clear the Zulu relationship with Shepstone was done. Bulwer had been monitoring what was going on and was deeply disturbed by developments. It was ironic that the Zulu chief turned to a British official as a mediator. Bulwer appointed a boundary commission to probe the dispute between the Boers and the Zulu. Both Cetshwayo and Freer publicly endorsed the commission, Cetshwayo naturally trusting it would find in his favour, and Freer believing it would find in the Boers' favour. The governor began to prepare a way to enforce the findings. In July 1878, the commission presented the report to Bulwer and Freer. To Freer's shock, the commission found that the Boers of the Transvaal had no right to be in Zululand. Bulwer's next dispatches concluded that Natal could maintain a peaceful policy toward the Zulu nation because it hadn't violated any agreements with Natal and the Transvaal. Freer was dumbstruck, and so dumbstruck he was struck dumb. He kept the report a secret for 5 months, preferring to continue his preparations for war than letting some important detail get in the way. Ah yes, politics, a place where ethic and truth go to die. While he pondered his next moves, Cetshwayo ordered the famous killings of the young couples I told you about last episode, the bloody marriage of the Ngunke. Then Metlo Kazulu, who was the son of Cetshwayo's pushy favourite Sihayo, crossed into Natal on the 28th of July 1878, along with two of his brothers, to seize two of Sihayo's unfaithful wives who'd fled to Natal. Metlo Kazulu dragged the two women back onto Zulu soil and promptly killed them. The British insisted Metlo Kazulu be handed over for trial in Natal, but Cetshwayo refused. That was a mistake, because all his main counsellors said that Metlo Kazulu and Sihayo had broken the rules and were in favour of surrendering the troublesome father and son. Cetshwayo, for some reason, wasn't thinking straight, or perhaps he was in a roundabout way. The British now had a firm reason to go after him, and his wisest counsellors knew it was grist for their military mill, but he realised that the British really wanted war at all costs. Even if he handed over the chief and his son, they would still want to fight him. Freer was after brute force. The Zulu were trying to avoid it. Meanwhile, the Zulu was still anxiously awaiting the Boundary Commission report, while Freer mobilised his army, knowing the truth. Only the British government could have stopped him, but he deployed all the bureaucratic wiles of a seasoned colonial official to obfuscate. On the 9th of August 1878, the British officer commanding in South Africa, Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Thesiger, established his headquarters in Pietermaritzburg. In October, he was going to succeed his father as the second Baron Chelmsford. So soon we'll be calling him Lord Chelmsford, a name which was going to be tinged with embarrassment in only a few short months. The Zulu were watching the power of the British Empire approach. Cetshwayo wrote a letter to Freer where he appealed for moderation and peace and asked for an explanation. What have I done or said to the great House of England? What have I done to the great white chief? I hear from all parts that there are soldiers around me. I hear that the British troops are now in Swaziland, and that they are there for the purpose of fighting the Zulu nation? Back in England, consternation grew. Sir Michael Hicks Beach had just taken over from Lord Carnarvon as the Secretary of State. Remarkably, Freer kept the Boundary Commission's findings from him and deprived him of information, pursuing his goal regardless of any advice from home. Despite the lack of info, Beach was growing increasingly uneasy as Freer's bellicose missives rolled in. Hicks Beach pleaded for caution and ordered that any war must be avoided. He wrote a letter to his Prime Minister in November 1878 saying, I have impressed this view on Sir B. Freer, both officially and privately, to the best of my power, but I cannot really control him without a telegraph. I feel it is as likely as not that he is at war with the Zulus at the present moment. Tensions were rising in Central Asia and the Mediterranean, where Russian ambitions were growing. The Second Anglo-Afghan War had broken out in late 1878, and a war in Zululand was going to complicate Foreign Office planning. It would be costly. In September 1878, two British engineers who'd been surveying inside Zulu territory illegally were detained as trespassers. They were released unharmed. Eventually, in December 1878, Freer made the Boundary Commission findings known to Cetshwayo. Shepstone's younger brother John, who was now acting Secretary for Native Affairs, met Cetshwayo's emissaries on the Natal side of the Tugela River. The Zulu were delighted with the Boundary Commission's report. What happened next caused their jaws to drop. Instead of suggesting follow-up talks, John Shepstone accompanied this information with an ultimatum demanding not only the payment of fines and the surrender of certain Zulu men to colonial authorities, but also the abolition of the Zulu military system within 30 days. The ultimatum would expire on the 11th of January 1879, following which the British would invade Zululand. It was at this moment that gunrunner extraordinaire John Dunn faced a crisis. The AmaZulu princes and councillors accused him of betraying Cetshwayo over the negotiations because he often acted as a translator. They called for his execution, and Dunn's nerve cracked. He decided to throw in his lot with the British. His huge family began crossing into Natal with their cattle on New Year's Eve, 31st December 1878. Cetshwayo was not going to execute Dunn. He was relying on him for advice about what the British were likely to do next. But Dunn could not be sure he wouldn't be targeted. Shepstone had told Freer that Cetshwayo's rule was shaky, and a military invasion would enable dissident elements to rise up. He made the famous remark, "The kingdom is like a huge ball of sand, with no larger base than a ball would have, and with only cohesion enough to keep its shape while undisturbed." Freer was delighted upon hearing this. It conformed to his thinking. The craven Cetshwayo, blood dripping from his chaotic hands, thousands of Zulus suffering under the reign of a tyrant, the whole system would come crashing down. It just needed a kick, which is precisely what Adolf Hitler told his generals on the eve of Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia. But there, he said, "We have only to kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will come crashing down." One wonders what Vladimir Putin said about Ukraine to his generals before his special military dilapidation. One day we'll find out. The Zulu king had ordered his Amabutu to prepare and already had partially mobilized in September and October 1878, responding to border alarms. Cornelius Vane, a Boer trader who happened to be in Zululand at the time, was detained and noted that ordinary Zulus were going around talking about these very bad people, the British. Rumours swirled that the British were going to seize all the men of Zululand who would be sent to England to work, and all the Zulu women would be forced to marry British soldiers. The cattle were going to be seized by the British government. Shepstone and Freer failed to comprehend what was going on inside every village in Zululand. The men were not talking about fighting for Cetshwayo. They declared they were fighting for themselves, since they'd rather die than live under British rule and lose their loved ones. The British were not planning to deport all the men, but that's how rumour works. The important thing here is the morale and motivation of soldiers. The AmaZulu warriors were not balls of sand, no, nor were they going to be kicked down like rotten structures. If anything, the rotten structure was that ponderous British column that was going to be cut down shortly. As 1878 drew to a close, the lead baron, Lord Chelmsford, was putting the finishing touches on his master plan for the invasion of Zululand. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I've loaded various updates from various episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, goodbye.